Voice of the International African Revolution.
Oh! Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Fitchman, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. I am the bluesologist based in Toronto, Canada, and we came out of the box tonight with the music of Celia Cruz and the Fania All-Stars live in Africa. That was recorded in Mobutu's Zaire, Lumumba's Congo, and that was when they had the rumble in the jungle with Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. There was a concert before the fight, and Celia Cruz is Cuban, but she was coming from New York, and the Fania All-Stars backed her up, and the name of the song was Kimbara, pardon me. And Kimbara is it's a word that it's not a Spanish word. It's kind of a mysterious word because it is related to it's a Yoruba word. It's an African word, but it's tied in with the whole question of voodoo and the spiritual religion. One of the religions of African religions is voodoo. But right now we wanted to continue, or before we continue, we wanted to say we wanted to thank two people, O'Malley Ishatella, Chairman O'Malley Ishatella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International, for giving me the space on Uhuru Radio to do diasporic music. And I would also like to thank Archie Shepp for giving me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And I would like for you to stay tuned for all the great shows we have here on Uhuru Radio. And let us continue with some more great music from Jane Cortez and her son, Denardo Coleman.
A very fine kunga of sweat, a very fine stomp of the right foot, a very fine platform of sticks, a very fine tube of frictional groans, a very fine can of belligerent growls, a very fine hoop of Cubano yells, very fine, very fine, very fine. Is there anything finer? Ole! Okay, 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 I say, I see Chano Pozo. Drummer, drummer Chano Pozo from Havana, Cuba. You're the one. You're the one who made Atamo into a tattooed motivator of revolutionary spirits. You're the one who made Impebe into an activated slasher of lies. You're the one who made Dono into an armpit of inflammable explosives. You're the one who made Obonu into a circle of signifying snakes. You're the one. You're the one who made a tampon's head strike against the head of a bird. Every night, every day, in your crisscrossing chant, in your cross-river mouth. You're the one. You're the one. Chano, 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 Chano. What made you roar like a big Brazos flood? What made you yodel like a migrating frog? What made you shake like atomic heat? What made you gel into a ritual pose? Chano, Chano, Chano. What made your technology of thumps so new, so mean? I say, is there anyone meaner than Chano Pozo from Havana, Cuba? Presence of ancestor Chano Pozo. Chano, flow, connector of two worlds. You go and celebrate again with the compañeros in Santiago and tell us about it. You go to the spirit house of Antonio Maceo and tell us about it. You go to Angola and tell us about it. You go to Calabar and tell us about it. You go see the slave castles. You go see the massacres. You go see the afflictions. You go see the battlefields. You go see the warriors. You go see the healers. You go conjurate. You go mediate. You go to the cemetery of drums. Return and tell us about it. I want to hear Chano Pozo. Okay, okay, okay. I say, did you hear Impetua smoking in the palm of his hand? Did you hear Iya Ilu booming through the cup of his flap? Did you hear Intinga standing on the rim of his rasp? Did you hear Sika Kuwa stuttering like a goat sucking hump? Did you hear Baka crying in a Nago tongue? Did you hear Fantan Fram speaking through the skull of a dog? Did you hear it? Did you hear it? Did you hear it? Of drones, a very fine shuffle of shrines, a very fine turn of the head, a very fine tissue of skin, a very fine smack of the lips, a very fine pulse, a very fine encuentro, very fine, very fine, very fine. Is there anyone finer than drummer Chano Pozo from Havana, Cuba? I say, I see Chano Pozo.
Thank you.
Alafia, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uber Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist based in Toronto, Canada. And we just heard Manteca by Chano Pozo and Dizzy Gillespie. And Chano Pozo was from Cuba, and Dizzy Gillespie, of course, was from South Carolina. And Latin jazz, I guess a lot of people claim that Latin jazz, Chano Pozo was one of the people that helped create Latin jazz, he and Dizzy Gillespie. And Chano Pozo was born in Havana, Cuba in 1915, and he was killed in Harlem in 1948 on December 3rd, 1948. And he was an Afro-Cuban jazz percussionist, singer, dancer, and composer. And despite only living to the age of 33, he played a major role in the founding of Latin jazz. He was also a key influence on the trumpet legend Dizzy Gillespie, and he co-wrote many Latin-flavored compositions, including the one that we just heard, Manteca. And he served as the first Latin percussionist in Dizzy Gillespie's band. And we are getting ready to play a commentary from Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report. And this editorial is called Black is Back Coalition Holds National Conference on Self-Determination and 2016 Elections. This is the voice of Glenn Ford.
Self-determination. It's a term that was once at the center of the Black political discussion. How should Black folks organize themselves to gain the power to shape their own destinies, and in the process build a better world and break the power of our enemies? Black people in the United States made great strides when we engaged in mass mobilization under independent Black leadership with the focus on self-determination. We set the terms of discussion and put forward principled demands that were designed always to result in the accumulation of more power in the hands of our people. Sometimes that involved elections, but more often not, because elections only occur every 2 or 4 years, while the struggle for power and self-determination is constant. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is putting Black people's self-determination back in the discussion this election season with a national conference on the 2016 election and the struggle for self-determination. The conference takes place on Saturday, April 9th, at St. Mary's Church in Harlem, New York City. The Black is Back Coalition will explore the possibilities and the dangers that the current electoral scene presents for the future of Black people and the world. This is a conference about power, the power to kick the killer cops out of our neighborhoods and establish Black community control of the police, the power to keep our people from being dispersed from the cities at the whim of rich corporations, the power to control our schools and the content and quality of our children's educations, the power that comes from economic security, the power to say yes to our friends and no to our enemies. The Black is Back Coalition was founded in October 2009, when a broad range of Black organizations decided to work together based on the principle of Black self-determination and the struggle against imperialism. President Obama had just begun his first term in office. The new coalition understood that the election of a Black corporate Democrat to the highest office in the land was not a step towards Black self-determination. In fact, it was quite the opposite. Obama's election meant that lots of Black folks would celebrate as their own incomes and wealth went further down the drain, and that many would be cheering while a Black commander-in-chief slaughtered people of color all over the world. And we were right. But something else happened in the second half of Barack Obama's tenure in office, the beginnings of a mass movement. And so we arrive at the current election season with both corporate parties in a state of flux, and most importantly, an incipient black movement that is anxious to transform the political landscape through struggle outside the ballot box. Which is why the Black is Back Coalition is holding a national conference on the 2016 election and the struggle for self-determination, Saturday, April 9th, at St. Mary's Church, 521 West 126th Street in Harlem, New York. To make arrangements, go to the Black is Back Coalition website, because Black Power matters. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we are getting ready to listen to the man called Benny Moray. And Benny Moray was like Bob Marley was to Jamaica, like Sam Cooke was to the United States. He was considered, I guess, the greatest, the best known singer coming out of Cuba, and had a beautiful voice, and he lived until 1963, and he did all genres of Cuban music, and we're going to listen to his rendition of Cienfuegos. This is Benny Moray and Cienfuegos.
Bueno, Benny, vas a complacer ahora a tu pueblo, ¿verdad? Vamos a ofrecer un número alegre.
Sí, pero no es de mi pueblo, no es por allá.
No es de Santa Isabel, ¿no?
No.
Es de aquí del estudio.
No es...
¿De dónde?
No me haga cosita.
Ah, bueno, tienes la cachimba clarita hoy, ¿no?
No, la cachimba está un poco...
Está bien la cachimba hoy.
Regular.
Bueno, entonces...
La cachimba vieja.
Bueno, tú vas a complacer ahí ahora 22 telegramas que tenemos en la oficina. De Cienfuegos.
Ah, me voy.
Entonces va a cantarnos Cienfuegos.
Perla, mi amigo, ahora le diré por qué. Una cienfueguera me dijo, Benny Moray, en una tarde de mayo, allá por Pasacaballo, con el rumbo a Rancho Luna, y ella me dio una fortuna en amores, y en Cienfuegos me quedé, ya tú lo ves. Como choca en la orilla mi hermana, de la roca que lo ataca. Me gustó ver cómo encaja el escambray en el llano. Me gustó el techo de guano, donde Guajiro nací. Pero lo que más me gustó a mí, si el nuevo pueblo cubano tú lo ves. Cosita rica como dice, como yo te llevo a ti.
Se puede por la ciudad,
pero cosa de mi vida, yo te quiero mucho a ti.
Se puede por la ciudad,
a mí no me digas que yo no te llevo, porque contigo soy feliz.
Se puede por la ciudad,
eres. Aprieta, muchacho, aprieta. Ay, pa' gozar, mamá.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, and we have had a half an hour of beautiful music from and about Cuba. We were listening to Celia Cruz. We also heard Jane Cortez. We heard from Chamo Pozo and Dizzy Gillespie, and we just listened to the great Benny Moore Ray. And Cuba is definitely in the news all over the world. And we're getting ready to talk to Charles Simmons, Baba Charles Simmons. He was part of a black youth group called Uhuru, and they visited Cuba in 1964 in defiance of the United States Department travel ban and met with Fidel Castro and Ernesto Che Guevara and also Robin Williams. And the story is that the group had to travel around the world to get there. And I'm on the line with Melinda Molly. She's on the line as well. But I wanted to ask Charles the first question before we get into the meat of the matter. Detroit newspapers, I don't know if you still have two dailies, but if you have you had the news and you had the Free Press, I don't know if that's still the case, but how is the Detroit press, the newspapers and the radios, handling President Obama's visit to Cuba?
Well, greetings from Detroit. I'm so happy to join you again, and hello to all your audience. We do still have two newspapers here, and I haven't seen the papers today, but they haven't covered much about this visit so far. It's mainly the focus has been on the political campaign, the elections, you know, between Trump and the Democrats. So we haven't seen a lot of coverage on this topic.
Right.
But I suppose there will be today, since he's going, you know, to arrive today. So that'll be an interesting take of how they cover that. And I suppose there would be more coverage if they knew about the state agriculture interest in trading with Cuba. But I haven't seen much news on that either. So that
okay.
will probably drive the coverage today.
You know, let me say that before I turn it over to Melinda, that when I was living in Detroit, I remember I was reading the Detroit Free Press or the news, and James Foreman walked into the house I was living in, and he says, you know, young man, so you got to read. If you want to read about Africa or Cuba or, you know, any place internationally, you got to read the New York Times, and they're not going to give you a correct analysis, but these Detroit papers as well as local newspapers all around the United States just deal with the local issues.
That's true. It's still true. And there's less and less local coverage in the local papers around the country. Much of the news is generated nationally somewhere and just sort of dumped on the local papers. So they're owned by, you know, such a small number of people, corporations. And so they have more and more ads, more and more sports and entertainment, and less news, and certainly less and less international news.
Right. I'm going to turn it over to Melinda now.
Hi, Charles. It's Melinda.
Hello.
Hello. I guess I want to take the audience, I guess, back to your trip in 1964 and maybe a little bit background of why, you know, the trip kind of took place at that time. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Okay, this was shortly after the Cuban Revolution, which was they came to power in 1959-60. And faced a tremendous mountain of opposition from the United States, which controlled Cuba. I mean, the United States had a colonial relationship with South America and Central America and the Caribbean in general. And so they were all basically client states. Most of them had presidents that were basically appointed by the United States, and they were totally subservient to whatever the U.S. wanted to do. And the various American corporations, AT&T, United Fruit Company, I mean, they've made the decisions about policy throughout Latin America. So the fact that this tiny country, a group of young folks led by Fidel and the 26th of July movement, it was a youth movement. They led a movement to eliminate this U.S.-dominated system that was really run locally by racketeers from Las Vegas, and it was, you know, basically a system of prostitution and segregation and intense exploitation of their resources and people, cheap labor. So they rose up against this system and were successful in overthrowing it. And then not only did they overthrow the old system, but they began to implement socialist ideas about a new egalitarian society in which women and people of color would be equal, and, you know, they would have control over their own resources and use it to build up their own people. So this flew in the face of everything that, you know, that U.S. foreign policy was trying to maintain. And we wanted to see, we were young folks, the same age as the revolutionaries in Cuba, in our early 20s, some of us were even teenagers, and we wanted to see what was really happening on the ground. And remember, that was also a time of great social change going on in the United States. I mean, great grassroots movements, Black Power, civil rights, and we were a part of that also. And so we were invited because of our own activism in Detroit in a group called Uhuru, which was very much like the Black Lives Matter organizations today, and very aggressive, in your face, protesting and challenging the system and police brutality and housing discrimination and everything. So we were invited to go by a group that had been there the previous year, and their intent was to challenge the State Department travel ban, which said that the Americans could not travel to Cuba without permission from the State Department. And they identified Cuba as basically as an enemy country because of this being sassy and talking back to boss attitude that the Cuban leaders had. And so we had to go secretly from our group in Detroit. Four of us who went from Detroit. We went from Detroit to Chicago. Now, all of this is being done as we consider it very secretively, clandestinely. And we in Chicago, we met somebody who told us where we're going to Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, we got a plane to Paris. And each step, we met more people gathering from around the United States who were going on the same trip. Young people, from mostly white people, but we also had about 10 Puerto Ricans, some from New York, some from Puerto Rico. We had maybe a couple of folks from Mexico and 10 African Americans within a group of about 90 or 100. So after Philadelphia, we got to Paris. We chartered a plane from Paris to Czechoslovakia, which is no longer a country that didn't exist anymore. But the capital city, Prague, is where we landed. There we met with the Cuban ambassador, who to our surprise was a man as black as you could be. You know, we looked at, he was pure of African descent, very clearly. Very proud, majestic person. Very articulate, and he told us that we were going to get a plane the next day to Cuba, but we had to go through several other countries because of this blockade that the U.S. had imposed on Cuba and all around the world in terms of its trading and having relations with other countries. So we went from Czechoslovakia to Ireland to Newfoundland to Havana, and it took us 3 or 4 days, it seemed, to get there. Because, you know, we had to zigzag going all around the planet to get 90 miles from the United States. But that really made it very clear to us that the U.S. had something to hide. They didn't want us to see what was happening in Cuba because they were telling so many lies about how dysfunctional Cuba was and repressive and totalitarian regime that was, you know, killing folks and enslaving people and, you know, shooting people in firing squads. All of which we learned were basic lies. We had been fooled, as the American people are fooled today, about what's happening around the world, what's happening in Detroit, what's happening with black people. I mean, they lie about everything. And so once we got to Cuba and met with, first of all, Robert Williams, who was an African-American, and his wife, Mabel Williams, and their family, who were in exile from North Carolina. They had just been there for a couple of years. They had been fighting the Klan in North Carolina. That's another story. He wrote a book called Negroes with Guns. We met, and Robert Williams introduced us to, you know, Cuban leadership, and we met Fidel Castro. We met, we had a special meeting of the African-American group with Che Guevara, who was one of the major leaders of the revolution, became very famous globally because of his work later on in South America and in Africa. And we learned about the health institutions in Cuba, which had, all of this had developed or was in the process of development since the revolution, because after the revolution, a lot of, there was white flight from Cuba to Florida. The CIA encouraged them to leave, and because they said they encouraged especially the professional people, the doctors, the people with the various skills who were running a society, they encouraged them to leave. So that would make the country just totally collapse. So Cuba had to start anew, basically training doctors from you know, zero, training teachers, training administrators, scientists, everything. They had, you know, all types of skills just from scratch. So they built a completely new society, these young people, And so that is what we got to see in process. There was a tremendous amount of passion and energy, a feeling of collective support for one another, the idea of using what you have, even though you're in poverty, use what you got until you can get some more. The idea of making a way out of no way, which was an old Southern view we had in the United States, but maintaining your independence at all costs. And so Cuba was the only country really in the global South that was able to stand up against the giants of imperialism led by the United States. I mean, other countries have fought to maintain that independence, but most of the leaders were overthrown. They were assassinated. The U.S. bombed them or something and, totally overthrew and destroyed the leadership and sometimes the entire countries like they're doing now in Libya and in Egypt and other places where the people are trying to assert their own sovereignty. So I mentioned the health system because Cuba became probably today the leader in healthcare globally when it comes to preventative medicine and healthcare for ordinary people. The workers have a better ratio of doctors to people than anywhere else in the world. In fact, the Cubans even give a scholarship today to black and brown people from the United States to go to Cuba free to get medical degrees as long as they agree to go back and practice in poor communities. Another area of tremendous progress was the education system. When they had to go from being a country with a tremendously high rate of illiteracy to now being having the best record of literacy in the American hemisphere, probably better than the United States. Their record of support for people in distress because of hurricanes and tornadoes, they specialize in emergency care. And in fact, when we had Hurricane Katrina here, the Cubans had 1,500 people sitting in the airport packed and ready to come to the United States to give assistance free to the people in New Orleans. And President Bush rejected it, saying that, it was coming from communists. They wouldn't accept that. Cuba's also given, yes. What is that?
No, I just laughed. I was just laughing at Bush.
Oh, yeah, okay. The other thing is that Cuba has given tremendous, unique support militarily to the peoples of Southern Africa fighting against apartheid and colonialism. So the independence today of the people in South Africa, Namibia, Angola, is the result of direct Cuba sending troops, tens of thousands of troops. I don't know, maybe they sent 100,000 troops, I don't know. It's a very high number for such a small country to serve side by side with the African people. And nobody has done that, sent troops to support us. I mean, we got rhetoric and good wishes, but nobody actually came to shed blood for black folks. And they did it because they recognized their own themselves as being a part of the African diaspora. Has had a large percentage of African people in Cuba and even others who have not clearly of African descent. I mean, many of them recognize their African descent anyway, including Fidel Castro. So I have to ask, well, what is the significance of the Cuban Revolution for people in the United States, particularly people of African descent? We saw youth leadership, intergenerational leadership, women's leadership, the need to go outside the box and create new solutions no matter what the problems are, having the attitude that we can fix it and we can build something new, having the courage to go ahead and stand up and take the position, well, if the United States is going to destroy us, then we just have to do it, but we're going to work to be independent anyway. And also international solidarity. It was important for us to travel to see what was happening in the world, and it's important for young people today to go abroad when they have an opportunity, if they're students, to study abroad. If not, to make sure that we reach out to people in our own communities of different ethnicities. We've got to know and speak their languages So we need to be speaking whatever language is spoken in your city. If they're speaking Arabic, we need to know and speak Arabic, Spanish, French, whatever it is, as well as some African languages, and get our youngsters, the kids from the kindergarten, you know, start them all speaking in foreign languages, studying foreign languages. It's much easier for them to do that. And also to recognize
Charles, I don't want to cut you, but we only have about 6 or 7 minutes, and I basically wanted to say, I have two questions. Who was on the trip from Black America, one, and two, what do you see coming out of the visit? How do you see the future in terms of Cuba with the new move with America coming in? Because I know Glenn Ford is really worried about the internet. He's basically saying that, you know, they're going to bring baseball and bring this and that in the internet, and the internet is the key. But, you know, that's going to give the Americans a chance to promote.
It's going to be a major onslaught of cultural imperialism of every sort. I would call it a high-tech new colonialism on crack. It's going to be so heavy. I mean, already we've got these huge cruisers, these tourist cruisers, dumping, you know, tens of thousands of people in Cuba at a time for tourism. And a place where the majority of the people are relative. And so that's going to have some major economic challenges for the local people. It's going to, you know, increase the stratification in the country. So that's a major problem. And I'm sure if Obama is going with the traditional American historical outreach policies, is going to be to create a new client state. So we have to be aware of what the Western countries in general are bringing. You know, all the negative things about American and Western imperialism are going to be on the scene to create a new whorehouse, you know, a new gambling casino. That's the Western policy. And to amplify the racism and sexism and everything else that used to be there. Now, you asked me who was there on this trip, Luke Tripp. We were all students at some universities in Detroit at the time. Luke Tripp was leader of our organization, Uhuru. He's now a professor in St. Cloud, Minnesota. General Baker was one of the students. He became a major labor activist in Detroit and social justice activist. He passed last year. Charles Johnson was a student. He moved to New York, and he's been an educator there. Max Stanford, Muhammad Ahmad, was on the trip, and he was one of the leaders of the Revolutionary Action Movement and lots of other. He was a major force in the social justice, human rights, black power, civil rights movement of the era, and is still active. He's been on the faculty at in Philadelphia. Temple.
Yeah, Malefia Santi got him fired though, but he was at Temple.
Yes. But he's still an activist, and he was here in Detroit. Stayed with us recently. Also, Bob Collier, who we didn't know at the time, but he came down, and he became he was a target with the Panther 21. He actually went to jail in the Statue of Liberty bombing case that they cooked up in 1965. This was just before we all got subpoenaed to go to the grand jury about this, just before the assassination of Malcolm. We're going to be teaching classes about this U.S. foreign policy in Detroit, studying at our new Center for Peace and Justice Studies here at the Hush House Collective in Detroit. We also have a bed and breakfast here for people who travel to Detroit. And you know, I'm doing a national tour talking about human rights and environmental justice, looking at, with a basis in the poisoning of our water and shutoff of our water here in Flint and Detroit. We're still the broader implications of these things in every community around the country. It's not just Flint and Detroit. And so those are as human rights issues that we're facing today. So we'd like for people to join us, it could be online or here in the city. You can reach us at the Hush House at gmail.com, the Hush House at gmail.com, and my phone is 313-896-2521 is our house phone, 313-896-2521. So wherever you are, I'd like to, you know, to speak in your area about U.S. foreign policy, about environmental justice or Detroit issues, and hook up with us for the classes at the Hush House Collective Center for Peace and Justice Studies.
But you know, Gordon Baker said last time he was on this very show, he said that that water situation, economic situation, may have started in Michigan and started in Detroit, but it's only going to get worse.
It will get worse.
And it will spread. And it will spread.
Yes. You know, in the NAFTA, my wife was pointing out that in the NAFTA agreement, the language identifies water as a commodity. And so water is seen as a commercial commodity to buy and sell. It has nothing to do with human needs or plant or animal needs. It's something that you can buy, and it's a tool for just making profit. So that this move to privatize water is happening all over the United States and globally. And that's going to be a big fight everywhere. So
water is the next oil. A lot of people take that position.
Pardon?
Water is the next oil.
Yes, right, definitely. And it's causing wars in some countries, pushed by this idea that it's a commodity. And so, you know, and I think it was in Bolivia, they had they passed a law saying that people could not even collect rainwater off the roofs. I mean, the folks rejected that, but that's the type of attitude that goes along with water being a commercial commodity. And the bottling companies, you know, are pimping us. They're getting the water free. And right here in Michigan in the Great Lakes, they're taking the water off the top, Coca-Cola and these people. And the people of Flint are having to pay for the poison water at the highest rates in the state. And so we still got people here in Detroit with no water. You know, they cut off people if you can't pay the bill. The water prices keep going up. And and I'm not talking about homeless people. I'm talking about people who are living in a house who have no water. And this has been going on for years. So it got a lot of publicity because of the poison water in Flint. But we have poison, chemicals in our air, the water, the land, the food. You know, it's a major health problem. The Flint situation is just pure genocide.
All right, Melinda, is there anything you'd like to say?
No, I think that's it. I think we have to have you on again to do a follow up. Watching
okay.
And kind of watching Obama's trip and see what comes out of that.
Yes. I don't know how much time I got to say, but going way back in U.S.-Cuban history and early American history, you know, the idea about this manifest destiny, that is the right of the European colonial powers when they came to America to take all of the land in the Americas. That idea still exists, you know, that they feel they have a right to take everybody's land anywhere. And so that is a part of U.S. foreign policy. And they're willing to back it up with the soldiers and the bombs. And so if the foreign policy is to be changed, it's going to have to be changed by the social justice activists, grassroots people at the bottom have to force these governments to change their policy at the top. It's not going to happen from the top down.
All right, Charles. I'd like to thank you, and I would like to remind people what we used to say in the 60s and early 70s is bombs, bullets, and BS. And you can, that was one of the slogans that we used to use, and it's still part of the Manifest Destiny thing, don't you think?
Definitely. That's right. That's right. And we need to keep that in mind when we're thinking about why is the United States doing something in a particular country. And that's the same. It has not changed. They use more sophisticated language and talking about terrorism. But, you know, we created the terrorists and still creating terrorists by the policies of colonialism.
All right, sir. We got to go. We're getting ready to pay tribute to Gene Corn, who had a birthday the other day. Gene Corn from Georgia, and just to let people know, Gene Corn can speak Russian. That's all African people. We have some scholars among us too, not just you.
Okay.
All right. All right, sir. Take care.
Okay. Okay. Goodbye.
All right. And Diasporic Music continues with a tribute to Gene Karn.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on WhoRadio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Richmond, speaking to you from the Great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we're getting ready to pay tribute to one of my favorite people. This is Gene Corn. She had a birthday recently. She was born in March. And I guess astrologically, she would be a Pisces. What Rick Holmes always talked about, Pisces, upstream, downstream. I'm not a star man. Let's listen to and pay tribute to Gene Corn. She sings Don't Let It Go to Your Head. And this is when she was working with Philadelphia International, Mr. Gamble and Mr. Huff. Nanga Def is Wolof, and Wolof is spoken by the people of people in Senegal, Mauritania, and the Gambia, and it's a greeting in Wolof. And we just heard Jean Karn do "Don't Let It Go Through Your Head." That's when she was with Philly International. Before she hooked up with Philly International, she was a part of a Black Jazz label, and she, her former husband, Doug Karn, they did two or three beautiful albums for Black, for the Black Jazz label, and we're going to play two selections. They covered Naima, by, which is a song by John William Coltrane. Naima was John William Coltrane's first wife. And they also did Lee Morgan's Search for the New Land. And they were singing about African people, you know, self-determination and African people having a piece of the earth. The New Land would be where Africans... obviously, they're singing about the African continent, but they are talking about African people searching for a new land. And this was a song that was written by the great Lee Morgan, the great trumpet player who was killed. And Doug Karn put the lyrics to Search for the New Land, and Gene Karn did a beautiful rendition of putting the words out there with her vocals. Jean Karn, by the way, used to be a member of SNCC, and she can speak Russian, and she plays many instruments, and a very talented young woman, still in the land of the living. Like I said, she just had a birthday. She's Pisces, for whatever that is worth. Let's listen to Doug and Gene Karn, and they're going to do Search for the New Land, and she's going to begin with Naima.
Naima, a timeless name for a timeless woman.
Land. I hope for the day that you understand. We must have us some land. I hope for the day that you understand.
Power to the people, power to all the people. We must use our power to make a new land.
Have us some land. I hope for the day that you understand. We must have us some land. I hope for the day that you understand.
Thank you.
together,
some land, I hope for the day that you understand. We must have us some land, I hope for the day that you understand.
Power to the people, power to all the people. We must use our power to make a new land. To be free, 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 freedom, free, free.
Uhuru, you're listening to Thai Spoken Music on Uhuru Radio, and we just heard from Doug and Gene Karn, and Doug Karn is a Muslim now, and he has changed his name, and he's still in the land of the living, still recording. He and Gene Karn recently did a reunion tour, and they are still musically together. But they are no longer husband and wife. And we wanted to listen to Gene Karn, moved over to Motown for a second in the 80s, that she did recorded with the Temptations. And they re-recorded If You Don't Know Me By Now. That was a song that was made famous by Teddy Pendergrass sang lead on it, but it was Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. That was, and this was recorded in 1982. And this is, I guess this is a great rendition. But this is Doug and Gene. This is Gene Karn with the Temptations, and they're singing Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. If You Don't Know Me By Now.
Understand me, like I understand you. Oh, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to break up my happy home. Boy, don't get so excited when I don't do everything right. Cause people only act like children. Oh, and they argue, fuss and fight. I've got mine, honey, you got yours too, yeah. Oh, just trust in me like I trust in you. As long as we've been together, that should be easy to do. Oh, get yourself together, or we might as well say goodbye. What good is a love affair? We can't see eye to eye. If you don't know me by now, you will never know me. Enjoyed a free love, a sweet and wonderful love. However, I must admit there was a time when I felt that love don't love nobody, especially me. But now I realize that with our new love, my darling, I'm so happy to be with you. Temptations, tell my story.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. On the line with me is Melinda Francis from Toronto, Canada. And on the buttons is Lisa Watson in Minnesota. And we are joined from San Francisco, the Bay Area. We're getting ready to talk to Mary Ratcliffe. And Mary Ratcliffe is the person behind the Bayview News, her and her husband, Willie Ratcliffe. And basically, we would like to welcome you to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. How are you doing today, Mary?
Well, I'm doing just fine, and I sure do appreciate this opportunity.
You have been giving me an opportunity to be printed. A lot of times, there's things that I cannot get printed in the city and the country where I live, and you have printed many articles by myself and other people that I know, so I appreciate that.
Well, I'd like to do a lot more. As a staff of one, I just have such a terrible time getting to everything. We're flooded with wonderful material. People are so generous to us because we don't pay anything. and we get flooded with stories, and yours are always just delightful. And I still feel so guilty for losing that one on Bunchy. but maybe we'll find it one of these days and we'll get it published.
The Bunchy Carter piece?
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
You know, the Bunchy, before we start, before Melinda asks you a question, I wanted to say that that there is a TV show where there's a running character called Bunchy, and of course they're making Bunchy look like, I think they turned him into a police agent. It's Bunchy and Charles Manson, believe it or not.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's sacrilegious.
No, but it's an NBC. It's a regular show. I mean, and
huh.
it ran for a whole season, and they're gonna put it back on.
Oh, Lord. Well, thank goodness I don't have time to watch, so I'm spared all that.
All right, I'll let
you get to a certain age, and popular culture just sort of gets less and less important.
So, Melinda, you
know, of course, it's important to me if it's important to our readers, but it's not something that I'm going to follow for myself.
So, Molly, you want to ask Mary's question?
Yeah, I guess me and Norman, we were talking about trying to find a little bit of a bio for you. So I would like to offer you to tell a little bit about yourself and how you got into the newspaper.
How I got into the newspaper, it was very indirectly. I had back in 1976, I was at my first political convention. It was the state convention of the Democratic Party in Fairbanks, Alaska. And I was at that time the head of the National Organization for Women chapter there in that little town. And I also had a good-sized nonprofit daycare center that I was constantly trying to get the legislature to address daycare for, everybody who needed daycare for the children. So anyway, I decided to go to the Democratic convention. That was back in the days when they still had a concern over policy issues and an opportunity for ordinary folks to try to influence people who would soon be elected as the legislature and the governor maybe and all that. So I went with a pack of 22 and had to sit through all these committee meetings while they deliberated over them and speak for them. And every single time they would be ready to make a decision, they would stop everything and say, well, we got to check with Ratcliffe. So, I mean, I only knew this guy by reputation. He was well known as a very, very strong activist and the head of the Human Rights Commission. He was not a commission. I mean, he wasn't staff. He was the commission itself. And the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights was the toughest in the country back then. They used to sue the state all the time when we moved down here to San Francisco and we suggested that the City Human Rights Commission sue the city. People were just shocked. But Willie Ratcliffe, as head of the state, the Human Rights Commission in Alaska, used to sue all the time. He was the one who got rid of the boarding schools for Native children, which of course made him absolutely beloved by Native people. And he made sure that the pipeline was totally integrated, and And because initially women hadn't been allowed in the camps, and he made it happen. And, you know, so anyway, he was real well known and very powerful throughout the state. And they couldn't make a decision on even an ordinary resolution without consulting him. And so naturally, I wanted to meet this guy. So later that very evening, in the middle of the convention, this black man comes walking up to me. And by the way, although I am the editor of a black newspaper, I am not black. And it's a birth defect. I apologize for it, but there it is. And so anyway, he walked up to me and was waving his finger in my face because I had just been telling somebody about a meeting that I was at where the head of the NAACP was there. And and he said, what makes you think that J.P. Jones speaks for the black community? And I said, well, you elected him. I didn't. So anyway, we got in quite an argument. And that turned out to be Willie Ratcliffe. And I fell in love right that minute. Boy, I wanted to join forces with this guy and try to make his gospel, you know, into reality, and that's what I've been doing ever since. And so anyway, we joined forces there in Alaska, and but after the pipeline, his power was definitely not wanted, and the oil companies were beginning to take over the state, which they've now done thoroughly, and they wanted him out. So we couldn't get any work. It just got absolutely impossible, and although we were still effective politically, we couldn't live. So he decided that I should go to law school, and he wanted to come back to San Francisco, where he had lived before he went to Alaska, although he was raised in Texas. But anyway, so we came down here to San Francisco for me to go to law school. And after I got out, passed the bar, I didn't like practicing law at all. I hadn't been able to find anybody to work with that was compatible, and we had an opportunity to take over this paper. And it was a little paper struggling, trying to the fellow Muhammad Al-Karim, who had founded it, was trying so hard to keep it going, but he just wasn't able to raise the money to print the paper. Printing is the big expense. And so I kept asking him if I could help him with it. And one day he came into the office and he said, you can have it if you can come up with $2,000 by, I forgot, 3 o'clock in the afternoon or something. And at that point, Willie was still going strong as a contractor. That's what he had done all his life. And so there was a general contractor. We had to work as a sub because blacks never were allowed to be the general contractor. And so this outfit owed us $2,000, and I went and sat in at the office until they handed me a check. And they never let us work for them again. But anyway, that's all right. We got the newspaper, and we went looking for somebody to be the editor and found somebody real good. But the first issue, he and I were working late that night. We had a date with a layout person first thing in the morning, and and it turned midnight, and the editor said, I'm sorry, I got to go home. And I said, but we're not through. And he said, I got to go home. So he decided that he just wasn't up to doing it, and I got stuck being the editor, and that was 25 years ago. But I have found my calling. I just absolutely love doing it, every single part of it, even the bookkeeping. And I need desperately now to find somebody to pass the torch to, because I'm 77 and I'm just I can't do this much longer. Of course, I'm going to stay in it as long as I possibly can. But that's how we came to have the paper.
Let me say that you have the burning spear, you have
there was a paper out of Mississippi. Charles Tisdale had a paper, and he passed away. It's still going on. And then there was the Bayview and the Final Call, of course. But, I mean, you know, those papers kind of, well, they don't kind of, they stick out because, you know, the San Francisco Bayview was always, you know, on the cutting edge. Like I say, it's the Burning Spear is the official organ of the African People's Socialist Party, but your paper is a weekly coming out of San Francisco.
Well, we're not printing weekly. We're posting daily to our website, but we're only printing once a month now. We just
I was telling Melinda that. Right.
Yeah. But yeah, we're still putting out a print edition, and it's still real popular, especially in prison. Well, it's very popular in the neighborhoods too.
And you're under the gun right now. Could you talk about the situation with the you raised $3,000 in order to print the print edition, right? And
yeah,
that struggle.
That's what the printer charges, and well, it's a little less than $3,000, depending on how many color pages and so on. But
how many copies?
Well, we've been printing. I'm inching back up toward 20,000. We've just been printing 15,000. I mean, it just hurts my heart when I remember that the Black Panther newspaper used to print 500,000 papers and get them out every week. And you know, imagine the influence you have if you can do that. And so I'd love to be able to increase the print run. But anyway, right now we're 15,500, trying to inch back up to 20,000. And and Willie's in charge of getting them out, and he drops them everywhere. The Black person in the Bay Area doesn't have to walk more than half a block usually to find a paper. Although they get picked up real fast, but yeah, they're real popular. It costs us $3,000 to the printer, and then another couple thousand to mail and distribute. And those are our basic expenses every month, so about $5,000. And you know, when you're when you're politically radical, getting advertising is tough because even people, well, I mean, there are a lot of people who would probably love to advertise, who don't feel we'd be too radical at all, who we know are reaching the people that they need to reach, but they can't afford it. So we have to somehow hit a balance where we can get enough advertising to pay for the paper. And we had been doing that pretty well up until the first several months of this year. The first 3 months, we had almost no advertising. And so there just wasn't enough money coming through to make those payments. And we had expected a large check that didn't come. And it was print time, and I put out an emergency appeal, and people were wonderful. And I have enough left from that fund drive to pay for this month, thank God. And after that, but we do have a few more ads this time too. I've been really hustling trying to do that. And we get money from subscriptions, and mostly nearly all the papers that we mail go to people in prison, and a lot of those go for free. It used to be around 85% free, but people are stepping up now. They realize that they need to help us out if they possibly can, and they're doing that. A lot of people pay in stamps, postage stamps, so that works, but. We're the only paper in the country that, certainly that I know of anyway, that widely distributes in the free world, so to speak, as well as in prisons, and we're in almost every prison in the country. And so that means that when we publish something that a prisoner writes, he's speaking to a lot of the world that matters to him anyway. And or her, and so we've been able to have something to do with the big resurgence in interest in prisons, and a lot of it interest that goes in the right direction. I mean, we had a president who went to visit prisoners. Amazing. And
could I ask you? I wanted to ask you a question. We have a few minutes left, but basically, I wanted to ask you. Your paper, most of the most successful black newspapers, the Black Panther Party's newspaper, the Muhammad Speaks when it was there, the Burning Spear, have had an intern. I have covered international issues. When I mean international, Africa being people, being of African person. So a lot of us covered Africa and the Caribbean, and the Bayview is in that tradition. And do you think that how important is that international news to Bayview?
You know, the reason that we started doing it, because when we started out, we were a neighborhood newspaper. And, I mean, we were a black newspaper, but we were a neighborhood newspaper. It was a black neighborhood, Bayview Hunters Point in San Francisco. And but when we took over the paper in the early 90s, it was the height of the crack epidemic. And you know, people had just lost all hope. And it seemed to me that, especially when I started to know more about Haiti and a Haitian organizer, Pierre Labossière, who was just absolutely wonderful, became a mentor, I thought, well, if we publish stories about Haiti, I mean, here are people who have no money, who only have the tradition of that tremendous revolutionary strength, and maybe it'll spark a renewal of hope in this neighborhood, and it, that seemed to help. It did, and so we kept going, and we started getting submissions from writers all over the world, all over the diaspora, and so we've had a whole lot to do with making Paul Kagame uncomfortable in Rwanda, because he's the one who's been kind of masterminding the stripping of resources from the Congo. And you know, we've actually had some influence. We've had influence in Haiti, but most of all, I think it reflects back to the U.S. and people seeing that being black is not a gag order. That you can do something. You can fight back.
Melinda, you have another question.
Yeah, I was just wondering about your transition to online and what that looked like, because I noticed that you went online like 2008, I believe, or was it earlier than that?
Oh, way earlier.
Yeah.
We were one of the first newspapers on the web. Yeah. Uh huh. We predated Google, so when Google came on the scene, we were already a newspaper, even though some people didn't want to class us that way because we were too radical. But Google has always considered us a newspaper, so we get real good Google placement and searches, which is a big boon. But yeah, we were on the web in 94 maybe.
Oh wow!
It was real, real early, and
I didn't even have an email at that point.
Yeah, it was just after we all started using email, we had a website, and started posting our stories, and that site grew until we were getting well over 2 million hits a month, and then in 2006, we were involved in a lot of really heavy stuff in Palestine, for one thing. And I don't know who did it, but somebody hacked that website so bad that it was on a big commercial server. It knocked out the whole commercial server for 26 hours. And we lost 10,000 stories. And we tried to get somebody to build a new website for us. Well, we tried to get the old one back. That didn't work. So in 2008, we finally got the website that we have now, and we just had to start from scratch.
Okay, I see. That's where I saw the beginning. Okay.
Yeah, right. That's why. Yeah, when you look on our website, there are very few stories. I posted a few stories from prior to 2008, but almost everything is from then on. But that's a while ago now, so you know it does cover some time, and people do. It's great to see how many people look the old stories. You know, they use it for research.
This is International Women's Month. How do you feel that you're a woman? How do you feel that you guys have covered women's issues?
Well, probably not as well as we should. It's not as easy to get women to complain. You know, we're so used to just taking it, and that's true of women in prison. They want a pen pal, but they don't want to talk about what's on their hearts and what's happening to them. They want to, I'm sure they do, but they're beginning to, and it really really excites me to see that. We've tried to do justice to the mothers of children who have been attacked by the police, and always hope that more of them will write, and some do. One of those mothers has gone on to be the main organizer against police brutality in the Bay Area, and she's always been ready to write a story whenever whenever it was needed. So you know, there's always tremendous room for improvement. But we're working on it.
Kino and Yasha from time to time has contributed to your newspaper. Who are some of the, besides Kino and yourself, who are some of the other women that are that write for the Bayview on a regular basis?
Wanda Sabir is the main one. Yeah, Akilu has done some magnificent stuff. Wanda Sabir has been with us now for, it must be awfully close to 20 years, 18, 19 anyway. And she's our arts editor, and it's been, I haven't been able to pay her since that foreclosure in 2008. She hasn't gotten time, but she's doing okay. She's a tenured faculty member at the Alameda College, or College of Alameda, it's called. And so she covers the black arts in the Bay Area, and nobody else does. So her coverage is just extremely important. She also works with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners. She's on their board, and she goes and visits prisoners all the time. She has a project right now where she kind of watches over a couple of homeless tent camps in Oakland, and just brings encouragement and good stuff to and food and so on to people frequently. And she is the one, I think, the main organizer in the country in remembering the ancestors. She has a celebration called Ma'afa every October, where people go to the ocean beach and perform rituals and so on. And it's just an absolutely beautiful thing. She has a wonderful daughter named Tassine Sabir, who has grown into a professional photographer extraordinaire, and takes pictures of that and many other things. So, and would you believe that of all the regular features we have in the paper, what the prisoners love the most, besides the prison news, of course, is is Wanda. I just love to read about all the cultural stuff going on. And of course they adore JR. He does a lot of cultural coverage too, and he's very good about concentrating on making sure that he doesn't leave the women out. In fact, he probably does a lot more women than men. So we have Wanda, and we don't really have a lot of other regular contributors. Anne Garrison, who's been writing about, she's the one who's been doing the Addie Kagami stories. She's a backbone. There are many women who do submit stories, but those are the most common ones.
And you do. We only have about 2 or 3 minutes left. No, we don't have that long. But you still. That one of the hottest potatoes out there, I guess, is Palestine. You still deal with Palestine, of course.
Yeah, and a young professor, college professor named Greg Thomas, has been sending us some fascinating stories. He's hooked up with a black Palestinian, and they've been doing. Did you hear about that exhibit that they did about George Jackson in Palestine?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, yeah, we heard about that. Yeah.
So yeah, and we're the paper that he's been writing for, and you know, telling us all about that. So we're still on that. Whenever a real good story comes along, I try to grab it. And
all right, Mary, I'm sorry, but. Can't beat this computer, and we have about 2 minutes left. I'd like to thank you, and we need to bring you back on and continue rallying support, helping to rally support for the cause.
Well, I don't think I made one thing real clear that I did want to make clear, and that is that we need a new editor real, real bad. I need somebody that I can pass the torch to. I know they're going to have to be paid because people just simply can't live in this world anymore without money. And so we're trying really hard to raise, my goal is 50,000, and if I could have 50,000 sitting there and know that I could pay somebody for a year, I'll bet we could find somebody wonderful. But we've got to have a young, black, fire in the belly editor. And so if anybody out there is interested, editor@sfbayview.com is how to get hold of me, or the phone number is 415-671-0789. Call anytime. It's home and work.
All right, I would like to thank you. I would like to thank Lisa Watson. I would like to thank Linda Francis. And we'll see you in the whirlwind.